Thank you for tuning in to the WOLA Podcast, Latin America Today, and the Just the Facts Podcast. It's Friday, September 7th, 2012. I'm Adam Isaacson, the Senior Associate for Regional Security Policy here at WOLA. It's time for another Week Ahead podcast. I'll be talking about Colombia's new peace talks, Mexico's transition and security, and shootdowns of suspected drug planes in Honduras. First, Colombia. On Tuesday, Colombia made official something I spent a long time talking about in last week's podcast, peace talks between the Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia. The 45-year-old FARC guerrillas are to begin in Oslo, Norway during the first half of October. President Juan Manuel Santos made the announcement on midday Tuesday the 4th, and FARC leaders made a parallel announcement shortly afterward in Havana, Cuba. Both sides named their negotiating teams. The Colombian government will be represented by a former vice president, two of the president's top security advisors, a leader of one of the country's main business associations, a former head of the armed forces who's viewed as a hardliner, and a popular former police general who just this year finished a five-year term as head of Colombia's national police. The FARC named two negotiators so far, Ivan Marquez, a member of the guerrilla's six-man secretariat, and José Santrich, who is Marquez's deputy in the FARC's Caribbean bloc and is believed to spend almost all his time in Venezuela. Both of these FARC leaders are considered to be more political ideologues than military field commanders. Ivan Marquez is a lawyer by training who briefly served in Colombia's Congress in the 1980s and participated in past negotiation attempts in the early 1990s and 2000s. Santrich once served as the personero, or municipal ombudsman, of Coloso municipality in the Montes de Maria region of northern Colombia. Both sides confirmed that the agreed-upon agenda for the talks looks more or less like a document that leaked to the Colombian media last week. The negotiators will address five topics: the thematic topic of rural development policy, the more logistical topic of political participation, including the FARC's possible future as a political movement or party, the logistical topic of ending the conflict, including a possible ceasefire, demobilization, and what to do about paramilitary groups, the thematic topic of solving the illicit drug problem, including alternative development and demand reduction, and the thematic topic of truth, justice, and reparations for the conflict's victims. Both sides have indicated their desire to go ahead with this process and stick with it to the end, and there's been an outpouring of international support. The White House welcomed the agreement on Tuesday. They issued a statement reaffirming the United States defense and security partnership with Colombia and praising the talks, but not specifically offering support or help to the peace process itself. In another press conference in Havana on Thursday, the guerrillas said that they want a third negotiator to be on their team, Ricardo Palmera, alias Simon Trinidad, a FARC leader who was a very prominent and visible spokesman for the group during the failed peace process of 1998 to 2002. Simon Trinidad was captured in Ecuador in 2004 and extradited to the United States shortly afterwards. Today, he's serving a 60-year sentence in the United States' super maximum security prison facility in Colorado. And he's locked up there along with people like 9/11 conspirator Zacharias Moussaoui, Oklahoma City bomber Terry Nichols, the Unabomber Ted Kaczynski, Francisco Javier Arellano Felix of the Tijuana cartel. The United States then is hugely unlikely to offer Trinidad any parole or sentence reduction, at least not at this early point in the talks. And most experts interviewed in Colombia's media seem convinced that the FARC will find themselves, at least for now, forced to drop their demand for Trinidad in the talks and simply move on. On Thursday, the guerrilla leaders also surprisingly said that they would ask for a bilateral ceasefire. This is exactly something that they refused to grant in the 1998-2002 peace process, when the Colombian government repeatedly asked them to carry one out. But today, 10 years later, things are much different. On Thursday night, speaking before a military audience, President Santos said he would not agree to any ceasefire and would, in fact, increase military operations until the negotiations have concluded. Why does Santos say no to an opportunity to negotiate in an atmosphere of less violence? After all, in 2002, President Álvaro Uribe readily accepted paramilitary groups' offer of a ceasefire when his government's negotiations with them began. One reading may simply be that the armed forces of Colombia don't want to be restrained right now in their fight against the FARC, and their support is absolutely essential if this thing is going to have any success. And the armed forces, and many people in public opinion, are suspicious that the FARC would try to take maximum advantage of any ceasefire with no military pressure on them to strengthen themselves. Without a ceasefire, though, the FARC's most likely course of action over the next few months is probably going to be to keep fighting, but to do so in a way that gets the most attention in Colombia's media. We could expect some attacks that won't make much of a difference on the battlefield or have much military significance, but will be sensational in nature and make big headlines. The FARC will use tactics like attacks on vulnerable military targets, attacks on populations, and perhaps even acts of terrorism in more populated areas, things like car bombs that create a media spectacle in order to target Colombian public opinion specifically. The result, of course, could backfire on them if they actually want a ceasefire or a peace deal. Polls show about 60% of Colombians right now, not an overwhelming majority, supporting the peace process right now. And this number will shrink quickly if the FARC carries out a bunch of headline-grabbing attacks. And if popular support shrinks, the peace process can't drag on for much longer. But this is all crystal ball gazing. Let's admit that. The process doesn't even start for a whole month, and it will be a long, difficult slog between now and then. Let's turn to Mexico. Last week, Mexico's elections tribunal formally ratified the result of the country's July 1st presidential elections. As was largely expected, Enrique Peña Nieto of the Institutional Revolutionary Party, or PRI, will be the next president of Mexico when he's inaugurated in December, and he'll serve until the end of 2018. Peña Nieto got 38.2% of the vote on July 1st, compared to 31.6%, about 6.5 points less, for Andrés Manuel López Obrador, the former mayor of Mexico City, from the leftist PRD party, and 25.4% in third place for Josefina Vázquez Mota of the ruling party, the center-right PAN. The elections tribunal ultimately ended up dismissing charges brought by the losing candidates, especially López Obrador, that the PRI engaged in widespread vote buying and vastly exceeded spending limits set by Mexican law. López Obrador continues to say that he does not accept the final result of the voting. But for the second time in the last 83 years, Mexico is now in a transition from one party to another. And the beneficiary of that transition this time is the PRI, which ran Mexico as a virtual single-party state between 1929 and 2000. This week, President-elect Peña Nieto met the outgoing president, Felipe Calderón, at the presidential mansion to begin arranging the transition of power. Peña Nieto also made public his transition team, many of whose members worked with him when he was governor of Mexico State in the last few years. Also on the team is a prominent politician from the leftist opposition, PRD, Rosario Robles, a former president of that party. She's serving as vice coordinator for social policy. Observers in Mexico also noted that the team includes a number of the PRI party's so-called dinosaurs, politicians linked to the governments of the PRI's authoritarian and corrupt past. These include a close associate of the controversial teachers union leader Elba Esther Gordillo, who remains a powerful figure in Mexico. There's still not much of a sense of how much Mexico's public security strategy is going to change under Peña Nieto. Miguel Ángel Osorio Chong, coordinator of political and security dialogue on the transition team, says that Mexico's army and navy are going to remain in the streets, performing public security duties at more or less the same force levels as during the Calderón government, which greatly increased the military role in fighting drug and criminal organizations. But Osorio Chong says that the goal is to reduce that military role eventually. This week, Mexico's Navy Secretary, Admiral Francisco Sáenz, recommended that Peña Nieto rely more on small elite units made up of, quote, select groups of military personnel, with much more emphasis on intelligence. Meanwhile, Mexico's police and justice system continue to investigate what happened 2 weeks ago Friday on the road between Mexico City and Cuernavaca, which I discussed in last week's podcast, when at least a dozen police ambushed and fired dozens of shots at an armored vehicle that turned out to be carrying two U.S. Embassy staff aboard. They were apparently employed by the CIA and on their way to a Mexican Marines training site. Over the past week, the tide of speculation about this incident has been turning toward the police themselves, the ones who attacked the vehicle. Their defenders say it was an honest mistake. Their story is that the police unit was looking in surrounding forests for the people who had kidnapped an official of Mexico City's Anthropology and History Museum, whom they had rescued the day before. Last week, it wasn't clear that this cover story was true and that the kidnapping had even taken place, but the rescued museum official, Salvador Vidal Flores Perez, came forward this week and defended the police unit. "It is unfair. It is an outrage," he told reporters. "It's incredible to me that they're going around saying these police are criminals." U.S. officials now say that whatever turns out to have been the reason for the incident, they now do not believe that the American's car was attacked because the individuals on board were Americans. Also on the Mexico security front, it looks like there's some truth to media reports that began a month ago saying that one of Mexico's biggest and most violent criminal syndicates, the Zetas, is splitting up amid infighting between its top leaders, just as it was at the height of its power, really. Apparently, the rivalry is between the cartel's biggest boss, Heriberto Lascano, or El Lasca, and the second-in-command, Miguel Trevino, or Zeta 40. A massacre of 14 men in San Luis Potosí in August appears to be a portent of this split. According to Reuters reporter Joan Grillo, who follows Mexico's criminal organizations really closely, he said, quote, "Interrogations of captured Zetas show that the split stems from disputes over shares of the cartel's criminal spoils. In June, hundreds of FBI agents across the United States raided a vast horse breeding business that they alleged belonged to the Zetas' second-in-command, Trevino. The news made other Zetas angry about how much money Trevino was taking, and with these people, anger can quickly turn to violence," a military officer told Reuters, end of quote. A split in the Zetas could be both good and bad news. On the plus side, it could mean a weakening of one of Mexico's dominant, most dangerous criminal groups, but on the other hand, especially if the state remains weak or corrupt in the areas of Zetas' dominance, it could mean a spike in violence in the short term and a bigger number of cartels to confront and contend with in the medium term. Finally, let's look at Honduras. This is a story that's not getting much attention, but has been widely reported in the Honduran press. On September 1st, Honduras abruptly dismissed the chief of its air force in a decision announced just a week earlier. This was not a normal time in the promotion cycle. General Ruiz Pastor Landa was suddenly out and replaced by Colonel Miguel Palacios Romero. That day, September 1st, the Armed Forces overall chief, General René Osorio, told the Honduran radio network, quote, "We're not happy. We're uncomfortable with these situations because we must be Hondurans with love of country," end of quote. What did he mean? It's not clear, but here are the rumblings being reported in the Honduran media. The Air Force Command decision was announced on August 23rd, the day before the commander of Southern Command, the U.S. Southern Command, General Douglas Fraser, was to visit Honduras. The next day, General Fraser and U.S. Ambassador Luisa Kubisky met with military officials and with President Porfirio Lobo. "We don't know what they talked about, and the military in Honduras has denied any connection between the Air Force command change and General Fraser's visit. But the daily La Tribuna newspaper published an August 24th letter they had obtained, a letter from Defense Minister Marlon Pascua to Foreign Minister Arturo Corrales. The letter said, yes, indeed, General Landa's removal was a result of General Douglas Fraser's visit. According to reports, and this still isn't all that clear, the Honduran Air Force may have shot down planes suspected of carrying drugs or forced the planes to crash on one or two recent occasions. If so, this appears to violate any arrangement that the United States has with Honduras for dealing with suspect flights that U.S. Military and intelligence assets detect as heading toward Honduran territory. Well, again, we're relying on media reports. These reports say that in early August, Honduras shot down a suspected trafficking flight over the Bay Islands in the Caribbean, specifically over the island of Guanaja, where the U.S. military has paid for construction of a Honduran military base for drug interdiction. The Honduran daily El Heraldo reported, "President Porfirio Lobo admitted that the Honduran government violated international accords regarding the fight against organized crime." Now, these operations are law enforcement operations in which ensuring that the people on the planes are really criminals is difficult, and in which the planes almost never have any way of actually threatening or shooting back at Air Force aircraft. These are usually very light planes. So lethal force is rarely authorized in dealing with them. There's simply too great a chance of killing an innocent person, as happened in May of 2001 when Peru's Air Force, acting on information from U.S. intelligence contractors, shot down and killed a plane load of family of U.S. missionaries over the Amazon River. Nonetheless, Honduran military leaders have vocally and frequently supported shooting down suspicious planes. There may have been another earlier incident, which the Honduran authorities deny, but which keeps popping up in press reports. On June 12th, 13th, or 14th, a Cessna plane was forced down and crashed in the eastern department of Olancho, perhaps with bullet impacts from one of the Honduran Air Force's Brazilian-made Super Tucano planes. La Tribuna published a picture of this crashed plane with apparent bullet impacts on a propeller. The two people aboard this flight died. One, many Honduran papers say, was an undercover DEA agent who had actually infiltrated the traffickers. If so, if Honduras overzealously took down a plane and killed a DEA agent, that would create a huge issue between Honduras and the United States, and a scenario in which the commander of Southern Command certainly might come to Honduras to read the Riot Act. That scenario would make sense. Right now, in an arrangement called Operación Yunque, or Anvil, the United States and Honduras have been jointly monitoring suspicious flights over Honduran airspace and trying to get Honduran assets on the ground when those planes actually are detected as landing. This is the counterpart to Operation Martillo, or Hammer, which has been monitoring maritime traffic along Central America's coast since the beginning of the year. And there are a lot of suspicious flights to monitor. In 2011, charts of suspicious flights show the majority of them coming from the Andes northward, leaving from Apure, Venezuela, in the south-central Venezuela, and landing in eastern Honduras. But the sketchy reports of shootdowns, especially the one possibly involving a DEA agent, seem to indicate that Operation Yunque is not going as smoothly as perhaps it could. And that's it for now. The U.S. Congress comes back next week. We don't expect a lot dealing with Latin America. They're only here for a few weeks, and then they leave again to go campaign for the November elections. But the House Armed Services Committee will have a hearing next week on, quote, a framework for building partner capacity programs and authorities to meet 21st century challenges. This won't be Latin America specific, but it will deal with, clearly, with the Defense Department's counter-terror and counter-narcotics programs out of its own budget, which offer assistance to other countries, which means there will be some coverage of U.S. military assistance programs that impact Latin America. Thank you for listening to WOLA's Latin America Today and the Just the Facts podcast. Please keep listening. We're up on iTunes, where if you have a moment to write a review, we'd really appreciate the feedback, and it would help us a lot to reach some new listeners that way. Please keep visiting WOLA's website, www.wola.org, and the Just the Facts website at www.justf.org. If you're finding these podcasts useful, please do consider making a donation to keep us going when you visit our websites. You can also find both WOLA and Just the Facts on Facebook or on Twitter at WOLA_ORG and Just F_ORG. Hasta pronto.